The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, welcome everybody. We're going to get started. We know some of you have 1 o'clock classes, and we want to get a chance to cover a lot of material here. My name is Steve Wormiel. I'm the Associate Director of the Marshall Brennan Project and part of the Program on Law and Government, which is bringing you this event today along with the Student Law and Government Society and the Office of Special Events and Continuing Legal Education. And we thank everybody for their help organizing this. The Supreme Court term begins on Monday, October 1st. Last term was a interesting and controversial one. It ended in June, one of the most conservative in recent memory. The court issued 67 decisions last term. Of those, a remarkable 24 of the 67 were decided by 5-4 votes. And of those 24, 23 were decided by a conservative majority, with Justice Anthony Kennedy making the difference. Only one was what you would consider a liberal majority, also with Justice Kennedy making the difference. In case it's hard to add up 23 and 1, that means that Justice Kennedy was in the majority in all 24 5-4 cases last term, which is in itself quite remarkable and unprecedented. By history and tradition, it is often the case that when the court has a kind of volatile and controversial term, the next term tends to be a little quieter and a little slower. It's not clear that that's really going to be true in the coming term. We probably won't see the court deciding cases this term on abortion and affirmative action, which were among the big hot-button issues last spring, but there are lots of other interesting, significant, and important cases that the court will be considering, and in just a moment we'll start talking about a few of them. The court that opens on Monday is an aging court. For the first time in a long time, we now have three justices in their 70s and one justice, John Paul Stevens, who's 87 and will turn 88 during the term. At the other end of the spectrum, we have Chief Justice Roberts, who's only 52 and will likely serve for a long time. So it's interesting to watch the evolution of the court in terms of age. There's a handout that I hope all of you will have a chance to take a look at that explains one other interesting thing about this court term, and that is that the court has a significant potential shortfall of cases. Even with a phenomenal granting of 17 new cases this morning at 10 a.m., and the list of those cases is on the very back of the handout, but even with those 17 new cases, it's likely that the court may hit an all-time low, not all-time, but low for probably the last 50 or 60 years in terms of the total number of decisions that they've issued. Last term was already the lowest number of decisions issued by the court since 1953. And in at least about a dozen of the past 50 years, the court issued more than twice the number of decisions that were issued last term. So the court is really at a kind of bottom of the curve, if you will, in terms of the number of cases they're deciding. And it'll be interesting to see whether they try to pick up the pace of adding new cases to their docket. What we're going to do this afternoon is talk about maybe 10 or so cases that are already on the docket. And then if we have time and there are still folks who haven't had to leave for class, I'll try to add a few cases that are coming up but not yet on the court's docket, interesting cases that the court might decide to take in the months ahead. Joining me to make presentations about the cases that the court is already hearing this term, and in the order that they will speak, are all WCL professors. On the far right, Mary Siegel, who teaches business association, securities regulation, and is going to tell us about an important securities case that's on the docket. Next to Mary, Professor Steve Vladek, who's a new member of the faculty this year, teaches federal courts, national security law, international criminal law, and constitutional law. came to us from the University of Miami Law School this fall. And then closest to me, Professor Cynthia Jones, who teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and evidence at various times and is the former director of the D.C. Public Defender Service and, like me, is an alumna of the law school. If she's an alumna, I'm an alumnus of the law school.
I was going to say
I was trying to be even-handed. So, without further delay, and so we have time to get to as many cases as we can, let me start with Professor Siegel.
Thank you for coming and spending your lunch hour with us. I want to talk to you about a very exciting securities case that's before the court. First, let me tell you what happened, and then I'll tell you why it's generating so much excitement. You had a corporation, Charter Corporation. It's a public corporation. And as you may know, analysts who watch the stock market price predict how much revenue a company is going to get each quarter. And if that company doesn't make that revenue, the analysts often recommend that investors sell the stock. And what that does is it depresses the price of the stock. Businesses, corporations have an interest in keeping their stock price high for a lot of reasons. So we had Charter Corporation that realized that it was going to be $17 million short of what the analysts projected for it. And not wanting to have their stock be punished, they, Charter Corporation, entered into what were very clearly and indisputably sham transactions with two of its customers, whereby it agreed that it would purchase an extra $17 million worth of equipment, and in return, the suppliers would use that same $17 million that was being overpaid to buy advertising from Charter Corporation, in effect using Charter's own $17 million to do it. How does that generate $17 million extra for Charter? Well, it's all for accounting reasons. Charter was able to turn an expense into a capital expenditure, which in essence means that they were able on their books to show that they spent a fraction of that $17 million, but got to record the entire $17 million back from their suppliers that quarter. That's what they did. The suppliers entered into documentation that would support these transactions. There's no question in this case these were sham transactions, that the customers knew they were sham transactions. No question that they entered into documentation to support the sham transactions. When the truth gets uncovered, of course, Charter stock plummets, and shareholders of Charter want to sue. And they clearly have a case against Charter, but what this case is all about is whether they have a case under the federal securities laws, under the anti-fraud provision, which is Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, whether they have a case against these secondary actors, that is, these suppliers who helped this transaction. And both the district court and the Eighth Circuit said no, they did not. Okay, and why is that? Well, it dates back to interpretations of the anti-fraud provision that, number one, there's Supreme Court cases saying that the provision, Section 10B, covers only manipulative and deceptive devices. For reasons not relevant here, we don't have a manipulation. So it's all about deception. And the court said that, in a case said that you can only be deceiving the investors if you make a misrepresentation to them and they rely on it. After that, they decided another case that's relevant called Central Bank of Denver. This is in 1995, and Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion, a 5-4 decision in 1995, that asked whether or not secondary actors, aiders and abettors, could be liable under Section 10B. And in this 5-4 decision written by Kennedy, the majority said no, only primary violators can be liable. So what has been going through the circuits is, what does it mean to be a primary violator? And the Eighth Circuit relied on the first case, on the deception case, and said, look, in order to be a primary violator, you have to be making a misrepresentation on which investors rely. And in this case, these suppliers did not do that. They did not make a misrepresentation on which investors relied. They helped the company, Charter, make a misrepresentation, and therefore they were only aiders and abettors. And under that pivotal case, Central Bank, they're not liable. In now, there have been cases, there's one in the Second Circuit, that said that accountants could be liable because they do make a misrepresentation when they certify financial statements on which investors rely, so that there are actors other than the corporation that can be liable. The question is whether these actors can be liable or not. The Eighth Circuit, as I said, in this case said no. The Ninth Circuit, in a different case, of course, said that yes, you could, in facts that would apply here, because they said if the primary purpose of entering into your device or sham transaction is to enable the corporation to make a misrepresentation on which investors rely, then you are a primary violator. Okay, so the real issue, and the reason this is generated, there are several reasons it's generated so much excitement and interest, is basically the case asks whether investors can get into the pockets of someone other than their own corporation. Can they get to the suppliers here? Can they get to accountants? Can they get into the lawyers' pockets? It's all about the liability of these secondary actors. To when will they be considered primary violators under Central Bank of Denver? And for example, if you think about the Enron case, although the investors clearly can go after Enron, Enron became bankrupt. So the question is whether the investors in Enron, the shareholders, can go after secondary actors like the banks, the accountants, the lawyers. The list is very long. And that's why the primary reason it's generated so much interest. There are a couple of other reasons it's generated a lot of interest. One is that the SEC, which is the agency that administers the federal securities laws, has 5 commissioners. And the commissioners voted 3-2 to ask the SG to file a brief in support of the plaintiff's position. Instead, urged by the Treasury Department, the SG filed a brief in support of the defendant's position. And so that has generated some interest because usually the agency that's administering the act, the SEC, is given a lot of deference. The reason that the SG went in support of the defendant's position, that is, supported what the business community was asking, is really based primarily on the fact that the Treasury Secretary Paulson headed a commission that has studied why the U.S. is losing its percentage of business listing in this country. The numbers are dramatically different. That is, we used to be the dominant place to list, and we are not anymore. And that report, called the Paulson Report, came out last year, listed a lot of reasons, one of which is the fear of litigation and liability, one of many. But that was a very pivotal reason why the Treasury Department urged the SG to file a brief in support of the defendants. and saying that, no, you cannot be liable unless you, in fact, make a misrepresentation or omission on which plaintiffs rely. And sort of the third kind of minor reason I think that this case is generating so much interest is that originally two of the justices recused themselves because they own stock in the parent corporation for one of the defendants. It was Justice Breyer and Chief Justice Roberts. Last week, Justice Roberts sold his stock so that he could come back into the case. So we now have eight justices who will hear the case. Still waiting to see if there'll be a ninth. But we do have eight justices. And of that group of eight, six of them participated in the central bank case, which was the one that held 5-4 that you can only sue primary violators. Of those six, three were in the majority, three were in the dissent. The two who were not on the court, who currently are Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. I guess my final point that I want to make is the importance of facts. There was never any contention in the original central bank case that those defendants were part of a scheme to defraud the plaintiffs. They just didn't take action, which might have uncovered a scheme that the corporation was involved in. The facts in this case are as pro-plaintiff as you can get. That is, there, as I started out saying, this is clearly a case where the defendants knew what they were doing. They knew it was part of a scheme. They issued documentation to support that scheme. So if there is ever going to be an expansion of primary liability to include those who knowingly participate in a scheme to defraud, plaintiffs have that case before the court.
Thank you very much, Mary. And by the way, the name of that case is Stone Ridge Investment Partners versus Scientific Atlanta. Sorry, I should have said that earlier.
So should I.
Professor Vladek is going to tell us about two cases, Boumediene versus Bush and Medellin versus Texas.
Thank you, Steve. Let me sort of apologize first. As you can probably tell, I've managed to lose my voice. I say it's because of a cold. My friends say it's because I've been yelling at the TV because the Mets are in the middle of blowing a 7-game lead. I'll leave it to you to judge which one is which. I should say at the outset as a caveat that I am the author of an amicus brief in Boumediene in support of the petitioners. So even if you actually were under the delusion that I am objective about this in general, I'm certainly not about this, but I will at least try to provide a fair summary. Boumediene is the current name of what really is the same case or a series of cases that have been pending in the federal court since the summer of 2002. These are habeas petitions, petitions alleging unlawful detention brought by non-citizens detained as enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay. There have been as many as 600 at Guantanamo at one point. We believe today there are about 350. The first time this case came to the Supreme Court was in 2004. Back then it was called Razul versus Bush. And in Razul, the Supreme Court held that the federal habeas statute did extend to Guantanamo Bay and did allow the federal courts to entertain habeas petitions brought by the Guantanamo detainees, even though the government had argued vehemently to the contrary, and even though the government and the D.C. Circuit had both claimed that the detainees had no constitutional rights to enforce on the merits. The Supreme Court said, we're not dealing with that today. All we're saying is there is jurisdiction. Go back and actually reach the merits. While that was going on, a separate lawsuit, which I should also say I worked on, was brought challenging the military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay, culminating in the Supreme Court's decision in 2006 in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. Hamdan struck down the military commissions as being inconsistent with both federal statutory law and the Geneva Conventions, and Hamdan also suggested, although whether it held or just sort of, you know, thought about it is an open question, that the detainees at Guantanamo do have rights, that they do have substantive rights capable of enforcement on the merits. Indeed, if they had no rights, it would have been difficult for the court to say that the tribunals were unlawful. In response to the Hamdan decision in the October of 2006, Congress enacted a statute titled the Military Commissions Act of 2006. For once, the name is actually an accurate description of the statute. The Military Commissions Act does a couple of different things. First, it explicitly overrules the Supreme Court's holding in Hamdan that the president had no authority for military commissions by providing statutory authority for the commissions. Second, it provides that no individual can invoke the Geneva Conventions as a source of rights in any lawsuit in any court of the United States. And then third, it says no court of the United States shall have jurisdiction to hear a habeas petition or any other lawsuit brought by a non-citizen detained as an enemy combatant or awaiting such determination. In light of this statute, in February of this year, the D.C. Circuit threw out these Guantanamo habeas petitions on the ground that the Military Commissions Act validly deprived the federal courts of jurisdiction. In other words, notwithstanding the fact that these petitioners have claims on the merits, the D.C. Circuit says the Military Commissions Act takes away our jurisdiction, and it is not unconstitutional in so doing. At the core of the D.C. Circuit's decision was the idea that the Constitution's suspension clause, which says that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it, does not actually apply to non-citizens outside the United States. And so even though the Military Commissions Act appears to be inconsistent with the suspension clause by precluding access to the courts via habeas, the D.C. Circuit says, you Guantanamo detainees are not citizens, you're not in the United States, you are not protected by the suspension clause, and so the statute is constitutional. What is strange about the way Boumediene got back to the Supreme Court is the first time that the petitioners filed their petition for certiorari, it was denied. And it was denied even though Justice Breyer filed a very passionate dissent from the denial of certiorari, and it was denied with a statement from Justices Kennedy and Stevens saying we're voting against certiorari because we're not sure these issues have really gestated, because we're waiting to see if the current procedures in place at Guantanamo comport with due process, and until that happens, we're going to wait. Now, what's odd about that is that was on April 2nd. On June 29th, on the last day of the court's term, the court reversed course and voted to grant certiorari, even though nothing had really transpired between April 2nd and June 29th, and so that's how this case got back to the court. The central question raised by this case is whether the D.C. Circuit was correct. Does the suspension clause apply to non-citizens held at Guantanamo and or to non-citizens outside the United States? A lot of the focus of the litigation has been on the idea that Guantanamo is different, that the U.S. exercises a particular form of sovereignty over the base, that by virtue of the terms of the lease, there's a particular kind of connection between U.S. control and military custody. And the reason why this has been one of the central arguments is because I think many people are concerned that the Supreme Court doesn't want to allow habeas for anyone anywhere. And so the idea is, you know, should the Supreme Court allow Guantanamo detainees to bring habeas because they're allowing habeas for everyone, or because Guantanamo is special and there are unique characteristics of the way they're being held? To answer this question, right, even if the court says the suspension clause does apply, that's not to say that the Military Commissions Act is unconstitutional. Right, so even if the court says the D.C. Circuit was wrong, there are two questions that come after that. First, is the Military Commissions Act a valid suspension of habeas corpus? The whole point of the suspension clause is that there are some circumstances where you can take away habeas and where you can deny access to the courts. And so the first question would be, is this a case of rebellion or invasion when the public safety requires it? My suspicion is that the court will say no. Actually, my real suspicion is the court won't even answer it. But I think the government has a hard argument on this question because Congress, in passing the Military Commissions Act, kept saying, we're not suspending habeas. The second question, I think the harder question, and the reason why this case is tied in so directly with other current Guantanamo cases, is whether, even though the Military Commissions Act takes away habeas, is there another remedy available to the detainees? And indeed, the Military Commissions Act does provide for a very narrow direct appeal of a determination that you are an enemy combatant or a determination that you've been convicted by a military commission to the D.C. Circuit. The real question is that narrow appeal close enough to habeas that the same things you could argue in habeas you can argue there? And that's the sort of the last question the court would have to answer. My own suspicion is the court will stop at question one. My own suspicion is there are five votes to say that the suspension clause does apply to Guantanamo, and they'll send it back to the D.C. Circuit and leave everything else for another day. But, you know, I don't play Vegas for a reason. All right, so that's the Guantanamo case. Needless to say, there are hundreds of issues I'm not talking about. It's a massively complex series of cases. But the real pending pressing question is, does the suspension clause apply to Guantanamo? The second case that Steve asked me to talk about is a case that couldn't be more different and yet raises some of the same questions of the separation of powers and the power of the executive branch. Medellin versus Texas is an appeal from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Jose Ernesto Medellin was convicted in Texas state court of murder. He was sentenced to death. Jose Ernesto Medellin is a Mexican national, and in a post-conviction habeas corpus proceeding, he argued that he has a right to what we call consular notification under Article 36 of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. In effect, this is like a Miranda right, but it's a right when a foreign national is arrested to be told that you have a right to speak to your embassy. You have a right to speak to a consular official. There's about 15 years of debate in American case law over whether this provision of the Vienna Convention is what we call self-executing, whether it can be privately enforced by an individual. The latest answer was sort of probably not in 1998. However, in 2004, in a case in which Medellin was one of the parties, the International Court of Justice held specifically that it is enforceable, and that it is enforceable specifically in the U.S. courts. And so Medellin came to the Supreme Court in the 2004 term, raising the question of whether the ICJ's decision was binding upon the federal courts. No, it was federal courts then. It was federal habeas then. Right before his case got to the Supreme Court, Medellin filed a successive state habeas petition in which he said there are two new reasons why I am entitled to relief. One is the decision of the ICJ in this case called Avena, A-V-E-N-A. The other, and this is where this case starts becoming macabre, is a memorandum issued by President Bush commanding the state courts to comply with the decision of the ICJ. And basically saying, I, the President of the United States, am ordering you, the state courts, to follow the decision of the International Court of Justice. So on Medellin's argument was either of these things, the ICJ decision standing alone or President Bush's memorandum, were sufficient grounds for relief. In light of these pending state court proceedings, the first time this case was before the Supreme Court in at the end of the 2004 term in 2005, the court did something which we refer to as digging the case. DIG is an acronym for dismiss as improvidently granted. My legislation professor in law school liked to say, can you dig it? My response is to make fun of him for thinking that was funny. But the Supreme Court digged the case 5-4. There were 4 dissents saying we should still decide this question, but they lost. All right, so the case went back to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Any of you who have not yet had the fun pleasure of experiencing the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, suffice it to say, it's the only court in the country that the most conservative appeals court in the federal court system has to look all the way to the right to see. The Texas Court of Criminal, you may agree with that, you may disagree, I think it's objectively true, but that's okay. All right, before I get into too much trouble, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals now had to consider whether Medellin was entitled to relief given both the ICJ decision and the memorandum from President Bush. And what the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals basically said, to paraphrase, is don't mess with Texas. First, that the decisions of international courts are not positive federal law, and so cannot of themselves provide the basis for relief in a state habeas petition. And second, that the President of the United States has absolutely no authority to tell the state courts how to do their job. That it's the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals telling President Bush that, I think, is a particularly interesting irony. But there's so what Medellin raises, now that it's back before the Supreme Court, is a host of very important and very complicated questions, the first of which is the decision of the International Court of Justice actually directly binding upon federal and state courts in the United States? And second, if it's not, can the President of the United States compel state courts to comply with that decision simply by executive fiat? I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. I think this case is a big mess, but I think it also raises in very, very odd ways the precise split within the Republican Party between states' rights conservatives and executive power conservatives. Right? The states' rights conservatives think that the president has absolutely no business telling the state courts what to do. The executive power conservatives think the state courts have absolutely no business not following. And so I think Medellin is actually a fascinating case where at the end of the day, the real question, whether foreign nationals in the United States have a right to consular notification, may eventually get answered one day, we hope.
Thank you, Steve. Let me just tell you the game plan. We're going to hear from Professor Jones, and then we're going to keep going till about 1:20, 1:25, if we still have an audience, and try to have time to take questions. Professor Siegel is going to have to leave a little earlier than that because she's got a class. But if you have a 1 o'clock class and need to leave before we're done, we understand. We'll miss you. And now Professor Jones will tell us about a case called Snyder versus Louisiana.
Good afternoon. How many of you know what a peremptory challenge is? Okay, I should explain that. In criminal cases, when you're doing jury selection, there are two ways you can challenge a prospective juror. The defense and the prosecution have an opportunity at the outset of the case to move to strike jurors for cause. That's the main way you can get rid of a juror. Someone steps forward and says, the police officer who will be testifying in this case is my uncle. That is a grounds to strike that juror for cause. Or I witnessed the crime that is on trial. You can be stricken for cause. Or I'm taking medication that will cause me to fall asleep frequently. All of those are strikes for cause. The judge will decide whether a potential juror will be stricken for cause. But historically, we've inherited from England and retained for ourselves the right of a peremptory challenge. A peremptory challenge is both lawyers have the discretion, after all of the strikes for cause, to simply strike another prospective juror simply because you don't like the way they look. You don't like the way they're looking at your client. You don't like some of their answers. Even though you might have lost your effort to have the juror stricken for cause, you can now use a peremptory challenge. The problem with that system is it is so random and discretionary, it's very difficult to police. And in 1986, the Supreme Court first articulated this formula for determining whether litigants were using peremptory challenges in a race-based way. Earlier in a case called Swain versus Alabama, the Supreme Court says you cannot take race into account and strike jurors based upon their race. And that is, it was an Alabama case, and it was excluding all African Americans from the jury using peremptory challenges. And since you don't have to articulate a reason for exercising a peremptory challenge, you could just strike all the black jurors and never say why you struck them, and there was no challenge. After Swain, the court moved to a case in 1986 called Batson versus Kentucky. And Batson provided a formula, a useful but not really good formula, for determining whether a peremptory challenge was race-based. Batson articulated this three-pronged test. So you're a prosecutor or you're a defender, the first thing that would happen is there would be a pattern of excluding, using peremptory challenges to get rid of all black jurors or all women, because the court later said the Batson rule applies to gender. And then the other side, the opposing side, would raise a Batson challenge and say, at this point, it appears that they're using their peremptory challenges in a race-based way. And if they establish a prima facie case, saying, Your Honor, they've used seven of their challenges and six of them have been to strike almost all of the African-American jurors, that would probably raise enough of a red flag that the court would then turn to the opposing side and say, you need to now articulate a race-neutral reason for why you have exercised peremptory challenges against these jurors. Now, this is the first part of the problem with the Batson analysis, and that eventually takes us all the way to the Snyder case. The court has said, and this is a direct quote, the reason given for the challenges, it can't be race-based, it need not be persuasive or even plausible. Direct quote, I could not make that up. And so what happens, as I know from practice, is that you articulate any reason and it doesn't take you very long and it's not very hard. If someone said, why'd you do that? And you can't say it was because of race. You're like, he was a manager. And I'm striking everyone who is a manager. He was looking at my client funny. And my client, you know, and a lot of times you can articulate a non-race-based reason without a lot of effort. And then the court says, and the trial judge should not overly scrutinize the non-race-based reason offered by the opposing side. And so you get a system where, you know, I say, it looks like you're doing this based upon race, and then the other side says, no, we're not, and the court says, they say they're not. As funny as it sounds, that's exactly what happens. And so the court began in a case 2 years ago, Miller L. versus Drutke. The court said, okay, this Batson formula that we came up with is not really working as well as we thought. We thought we were fixing the problem from Swain versus Alabama that made it impossible to establish a pattern of racial discrimination in peremptory challenges by coming up with this three-step test, but the test isn't exactly working. And the court took a more comprehensive look at the test and said, well, one of the things that you can take into account is the entire history of the case, not just what happened during the peremptory challenge, the voir dire phase. And if there are other instances that seem to suggest that race was a factor, and in Miller L. versus Drutke, one of the things the court took into account was an entire history of sort of formalized, it is our practice to exclude African-American jurors. It's a hint that maybe they're engaging in race-based discrimination. The court said that can be taken into account, even though it is beyond the scope of exactly what was on the record in this case. And then in Snyder versus, in State v. Snyder, where the defendant was convicted and sentenced to death, he appealed his conviction, and it was in the pipeline when the Miller L. versus Drutke decision was decided, and the Supreme Court vacated his conviction and remanded the case and said, now, please reconsider your decision on Snyder's contention that the peremptory challenges were exercised in a race-based way in light of our clarification or our purported clarification of the Batson test in Miller L. versus Drutke. Well, not surprisingly, the Louisiana court said, we think the same thing we thought the first time. Everything was fine. The prosecutor gave a reason. It wasn't particularly plausible or persuasive, nor did it have to be, and we agree that it wasn't race-based. And so the case is now back up before the Supreme Court for the court to really have one more chance at trying to clarify exactly what it means when it says articulate this non-plausible, non-persuasive, non-race-based reason, and then what the court's review of that decision should be. In another case decided after Miller versus Drutke, when it seemed that the court was leaning more towards holding the government accountable, and this Collins case, the court said, yeah, but you shouldn't overly scrutinize what the government says. So everyone's saying, well, somewhere between Miller L. and Collins, we've got to figure out how do we, you know, in earnest evaluate whether this is a race-based challenge and at the same time not overly scrutinize the decision made by the trial court. So in Snyder, the defendant was on trial and it was a domestic violence killing. He caught his wife and another person in a car. He stabbed the other person to death and tried to stab his wife to death, stabbed her 15 times. She survived and she testified. And he was charged with the first degree murder and the aggravated attempted murder on his wife. And he said during trial, pretrial, the government made some reference to trying to get in what my evidence students will recognize as 404B evidence. They wanted to introduce evidence of other crimes or prior bad acts that the defendant wasn't charged with, other acts of domestic violence. The defendant said, no, Your Honor, we oppose that. And the government made some reference at this pretrial hearing to the O.J. Simpson case. And they said, you know, this is relevant just like O.J. And the defense said, wait a minute, in a case decided right about the time of the O.J. after the O.J. Simpson verdict with an all-white jury, no reference should be made to the O.J. Simpson case. It just injects race in the case. It's unfair. And the government said unequivocally, we absolutely will not do that. We have no intention of doing it. We asked the court to deny the motion in limine to preclude us from doing it, but we're not going to do it anyway. You know they did it, right? Okay, so the case proceeds and the government exercises its peremptory challenges, and with five of their peremptory challenges, they manage to get rid of all of the African-American prospective jurors, and the defendant is tried before an all-white jury. The reason given by the government, and they gave two reasons. One was, well, the one juror said that he was a student teacher and that he was concerned about missing some classes, and we thought that if he was concerned about missing classes, that he might find the defendant guilty, not of first-degree murder, making him eligible for the death penalty, but of second-degree murder. And then, as a result of that, there would be no penalty phase, and the trial would be over quicker, and he could get back to school. And then the defense said, but we contacted his school. This is kind of an odd procedure during voir dire. They contacted the dean of the school who said, oh, no, 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 if he misses class for a week, it'll be fine. They tell the prospective juror that, and he says, oh, okay. Notwithstanding that, the government said, yeah, he still seemed unsure about that. And the second reason articulated by the government, it's, you know, non-plausible, non-race-based reason, was that the defendant, that the prospective juror appeared a bit nervous. And the court made no finding whatsoever, and the defense lawyer, who seems like such a character, says, everybody seems nervous. Hell, I'm nervous. And I thought, that must be so comforting to the defendant who's facing the death penalty. You're nervous. At any rate, the court says that those two reasons are non-race-based reasons and that they're perfectly fine, and that therefore, even in light of Miller L. versus Drecke, it's perfectly fine and there was no violation of the Batson rule in this case. The interesting thing, there are two interesting things about this case. One is what the Supreme Court could do, but absolutely won't do, is eliminate peremptory challenges. It has become abundantly clear, and everyone agrees, it's not a constitutional requirement. It's a historical accident that we still have them. We inherited them from England, and England has even gotten rid of them for the very reason that it's so discretionary and it allows people to engage in all kinds of discrimination against jurors. But even though we've held, our courts have held, it's not a constitutional mandate, there is an equal protection component, and so the court probably will not eliminate peremptory challenges, even though there's sort of a big cry for eliminating them, just as Marshall in Batson in his dissent said, we need to just get rid of them. Other law professors and scholars have said, this is not working, we need to get rid of it. There's no way you can have a discretionary decision where all I have to do is come up with a, you know, a gut feeling reason for not discriminating, not for striking someone, and that's sufficient. There's no way you can police the racism. And now we have a Supreme Court justice, Justice Breyer, is saying, you know, it's time to get rid of peremptory challenges. And I thought, wow. So it should be interesting, though I don't think there are the votes there. I don't think there's the impetus to completely get rid of peremptory challenges. But I think what the court is going to have to do in Snyder is reconcile what is a growing conflict between, you know, what you want to have happen, an actual procedure to evaluate whether race is taken into account, and what they have allowed to happen with Collins and some of the other cases, is this sort of loosey-goosey standard where courts aren't quite sure exactly how exacting they should be in demanding a race-neutral reason and how much they should scrutinize what the prosecutor or the defense attorney says. And the Batson challenges apply both ways. So the Snyder Court presents this very interesting dynamic where the court has to figure out how closely are we going to look at the reasons, and if the trial court has made a decision that it's not discriminatory, how closely are we going to evaluate what the trial court has decided. And in the Snyder case, the dissent from the Louisiana State Supreme Court says that actually the judges said, I actually think that it was discriminatory. It's very difficult to establish that someone's discriminating in this manner, but they pointed to the fact that the reasons given by the prosecutor appear to be pretextual. One, there was never a finding that this juror was nervous, and in fact, this particular African-American juror was very engaged throughout the voir dire process, not appearing nervous at all, raising his hand to volunteer to answer questions. You know, one question posed to the prospective jurors during voir dire was, what would be a reason why a criminal defendant might not testify? And this, you know, nervous, uncomfortable juror said, you know, oh, I know, maybe because he might damage his credibility. I'm thinking and the court said he doesn't appear to be nervous at all. He was very engaged. And with respect to he was afraid of missing school, the court pointed to several non-African-American jurors who also expressed concerns about the length of time they would be away from their job. They weren't stricken by the government. And the court says, while none of those factors alone are sufficient, in total, that should be sufficient to establish that the prosecutor's reasons were pretextual, coupled with the fact of the O.J. Simpson reference, the pretrial statement, we're not going to mention O.J., and then later in the case, the government says that the part of the defense here was insanity, and the defense attorney argued that the defendant, when he was eventually caught, was in a fetal position. He was crying. The house was, you know, a mess. And they said, this is obviously a sign that this man has suffered some mental disturbance and was suicidal. And the prosecutor said, oh, Jake did the same thing. He was riding in a Ford Bronco, threatening to commit suicide. You think this defendant wasn't thinking of O.J. Simpson at the time he did this? And the defense attorney said, objection, Your Honor. He mentioned O.J., he wasn't supposed to, and the court said, overruled. So the issue becomes, and I don't think the O.J. issue will at all be dispositive, but the issue becomes in Snyder, will the court take this opportunity to further define the Batson test such that it's more strictly enforced, or will the court pass on this opportunity and leave this area of the law really amorphous so that we still have the potential for racism in jury selection, particularly in the South? Interestingly enough, in the District of Columbia, where we have, in many cases, a majority black population of people, and as a criminal defense attorney, the issue was always the defense being Batsoned, as we call it, because the defense was always accused of, allegedly, striking the white jurors. So the Batson was originally designed to make sure you had a more racially diverse jury, mostly to include African Americans. The District of Columbia may be the only place where it's just the opposite here. Everywhere else, it's like, you know, the defense attorneys love Batson and they're trying to enforce it, and here the defense attorneys hate Batson and they really want it to go away. Either way, the issue of peremptory challenges, stay tuned. We'll see what the Supreme Court does.
Thank you, Professor Jones. I want to quickly go through some other cases, including some that I haven't had much time to look at because the court just granted them this morning, but let me mention some of them. So I've studied them in great detail. Probably most exciting on the list of 17 cases that the court granted this morning is the case involving voter identification laws. There are a number of states in the country that have passed laws requiring that voters present some form of government-issued photo ID when they come to the polls. I think the number is up to about 4 states that now have those laws, and there are another dozen state legislatures that have laws like that pending in front of them in the coming legislative sessions next year. One of the most restrictive such laws is in Indiana, where everybody has to have a photo ID. If you don't have one, you can cast a provisional ballot, and then you have to go get some kind of ID and come back to the seat of government and produce that ID within 30 days and establish that you are who you said you are. This is really a case about poor people. It's a case about people who don't have the means to go back to the seat of government and produce that ID. The New York Times yesterday in an article mentioned that somewhere between 13 million and 22 million voting age Americans don't have driver's licenses, passports, or other forms of government issued ID. So the Indiana law was challenged and was upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in an opinion by the famous, well-known Judge Richard Posner. Judge Posner said he didn't think it was such a big imposition on people to have to produce photo ID. Interestingly, he said that the government's interest in making sure that there isn't voter fraud as the justification for the photo IDs was not really supported by any instances of prosecution for voter fraud. And every other judge who's considered this case has sort of said the same thing. The states say we're trying to prevent voter fraud, but the states are not offering any evidence of having prosecuted anybody for voter fraud. And so one of the dissenting judges in the Seventh Circuit said, shouldn't we wait until there's some evidence before we pass these laws requiring that somebody have to produce voter ID? Usually the clever lines in a case in which Judge Posner is involved come from him, but the dissenting judge in the Seventh Circuit said that the Indiana law was using a sledgehammer to hit either a real or imaginary fly on a glass coffee table. So the court this morning agreed to hear the Indiana case, which means this will be closely watched by state legislatures all over the country. If the court upholds voter ID laws, then I think you will see numerous additional states pass voter ID laws. And obviously, if they strike it down, it will send states back to the drawing board. The question, in a sense, is the legal question is really how do we define the burden on voters and how do we measure it? Is the question the number of voters affected, or is it sufficient if even a small number of voters would have their right to vote significantly burdened by these voter ID laws? And we'll have to wait and see which way the court's going to go on that. The court also this morning, and I've had no time to look at this one, but it seems like it will be of enormous interest, agreed to hear a case called Bays versus Rees. It's a Kentucky death penalty case in which the issue appears to be the standard by which a court should determine how much risk of pain and suffering to somebody who is about to be executed by lethal injection, how much risk that the lethal injection will cause undue pain and suffering is too much risk. The petition asks the court to choose between the standard that there's a substantial risk of wanton infliction of pain, which seems to be the prevailing standard. In other words, we can execute somebody by lethal injection unless there is a substantial risk of wanton infliction of pain. But the petition suggests that in many cases now where the efficiency, for lack of a better term, of lethal injection seems to be in question, and there seems to be some evidence that this means of execution is causing more pain and suffering than was believed when the method was adopted. So the petition actually asks if there is unnecessary risk of infliction of pain, whether that satisfies the requirements of the Eighth Amendment and lethal injection could be stopped on that basis. So it's really kind of a lower threshold that would be used to measure the appropriate standard. Again, the court agreed to hear that case this morning. A couple of cases that the court had already agreed to hear. One called U.S. versus Williams, which is Congress's latest attempt to deal with child pornography. In 1996, Congress passed the Child Pornography Prevention Act. And in 2002, the Supreme Court struck down portions of that act because what it prohibited was not simply actual production and sale and distribution of child pornography. It prohibited also the production, sale, distribution of virtual child pornography. In other words, if they were not real images of children engaged in sexual acts, if they were computer-generated images, Congress was still trying to ban that. The underlying theory here, my apologies to my First Amendment students who sat through this discussion last night, the underlying theory here is that the court has said in a couple of cases that the very existence of a market for child pornography, the market itself harms the children who are drawn into the making of child pornography involuntarily. In other words, if there is a market for the sale, distribution, whatever, of child pornography, then more children will be exploited into making films, and that will hurt those children. Based on that assumption, Congress says, well, gee, we ought to ban every aspect of the market. Let's criminalize every facet of the market. That's what they tried to do in 1996. The court said that it was too broad, that virtual images of child pornography might include protected speech. Speech that wasn't obscene, which would make it illegal, but it wasn't obscene. And speech that wasn't actually child pornography because it didn't actually involve images of children. And so it wasn't illegal on that basis. Congress came back in 2003, and I'd like to meet the, there must be some hidden office on Capitol Hill where people write the names of statutes in order to be able to come up with acronyms. This one is known as the Prosecutorial Remedies and Other Tools to End the Exploitation of Children Today Act, which stands for PROTECT. So it's known as the PROTECT Act, but I really would be curious to know who the person was that came up with that.
He's protected by law.
Thank you. What the new law did in 2003, it's a lengthy statute, the part that's before the court in U.S. versus Williams, makes it a crime to offer or to either offer to sell or offer to distribute or offer to buy material not just that is actually child pornography, but that purports to be illegal material. And the way the statute actually works, I'm not making this up, this is what Congress did, is that you could actually have a situation in which there is no real child pornography being offered, but you, for whatever reason, have represented in an email message to somebody else that, hey, I've got hot child pornography pictures available for you to buy. They're pictures of a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old or whatever, and, get in touch with me and I'll make them available to you. And maybe you don't actually have any real child pornography in your possession. The act of pandering that material on the internet to somebody or in some other means would violate the statute. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit said that was unconstitutionally overbroad. Same reasons, really, as the 2002 decision, that it involves material that would not be obscene and wouldn't necessarily be child pornography, the two ways that it could be illegal, because there isn't even any material necessarily required. The government doesn't actually have to prove that you possess anything. It just has to prove that you made the offer, that you were in effect pandering the commercial or even non-commercial offering of child pornography. So the Justice Department has appealed that to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will hear arguments in that one on October 30th. Let me mention a couple of others, actually maybe one other quickly, that the court has agreed to hear, and then two that the court hasn't yet agreed to hear. One that the court has agreed to hear is called Board of Education of New York City versus Tom F. It's a very interesting special ed case. Involving the Individuals with Disability Education Act, IDEA, and 1997 amendments to it. basically, as simply as I can put this, and I'm very much oversimplifying, federal law requires that a school system provide an individualized education plan for children who need special ed services, who qualify for special ed services. And part of that plan has to be offering the child an appropriate school placement in that school system. If the school system can't provide an appropriate school placement, then the law says the child should be allowed to go to a private school and the parents should be reimbursed for the cost of that tuition by the school system. Okay. The question in this case, which is sort of a technical but practically very important one, is when the school system offers a placement under special ed program to a child, if the parents have reason to believe that that placement is inadequate or not as good as a placement they could get at a private school. Classes are bigger in the public school. The kid would get more attention in the private school, for example. If the parents believe that the alternative placement in a private school would be a better placement and that what has been offered to them by the public school system is not adequate, do they have to send the child to the public school first and try it out before they can then go to a hearing officer and try to have that placement declared inadequate and then move the kid to a private school? Or can they seek that determination up front and send the kid right to private school? And the father in this case is a very wealthy individual, which makes it in some ways more interesting. He was the founder of MTV and a former executive at Viacom, Gilbert Freston. Tom Freston was the father. The son's name is Gilbert. So it's really, now the father says it's not about the money. He doesn't need the money. It's about the principle that he ought to be able to place his child in the best placement for the child and not have to use his child as a guinea pig to send him to the placement offered by the school system if it's believed to be inadequate. The practical importance both ways is enormous. There are thousands and thousands of kids who face this situation, and there's also tens of millions of dollars spent by school systems on reimbursement for private school placements. So I think that's another one that will be quite interesting to watch. Two last points really quickly. These now are cases that the Supreme Court has not yet agreed to hear, but that I think are very interesting to watch. The court in the next month or so, 6 weeks, should decide whether it's going to hear these cases. And there are lots that we could talk about. I've picked a couple that I thought were most interesting. There are about four or five states in the United States that allow in some way for the death penalty to be applied to cases of rape where there's no murder involved. Okay? Most capital cases involve some form of murder. But there are a handful of states, some of them it's a second offense, but in Louisiana it's a first offense for the rape of a child under the age of 12. That's what the Louisiana law says. If you rape a child under the age of 12, it's a capital crime and you can be sentenced to death. The problem and the interesting issue that the petition presents is that in 1977, in a case called Coker versus Georgia, the Supreme Court said that capital punishment couldn't be used for cases of rape without violating the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment clause. The facts of Coker involved the rape of a 16-year-old teenager. And what Louisiana says is just that. Coker involved the rape of a 16-year-old. Our law is for the rape of younger victims. Therefore, the death penalty is justified, and the case is not governed by the decision in Coker versus Georgia. The case is named Patrick Kennedy versus Louisiana. He's convicted of raping an 8-year-old girl. The Louisiana Supreme Court upheld his conviction and upheld the Louisiana law. And so the Supreme Court is being asked to take this case. Again, they have not yet agreed to hear it. It's one that they'll look at sometime in the next month, month and a half to decide whether to take the case or not. It will be very interesting to see which way the court goes on that, whether they take it and whether they and how they decide it. And then the last one I want to mention, which is one that you all have heard a lot about, I am sure, is the D.C. gun case. Again, this is not one that the court has agreed to hear yet. The court will probably decide in late October or early November whether to hear this case. But the case presents maybe the most interesting opportunity for the Supreme Court to shed some light on the meaning of the Second Amendment, which, as interpreted by the Supreme Court in 1939 and not really since then, has no meaning. The Second Amendment, as interpreted by the court in 1939, does not confer on individuals a right to bear arms, does not really apply to the states. The court more or less said in that case that the right was a right of militia to be armed in the states and to defend their states, that that's all it meant. And the court has declined several opportunities to revisit that in recent years. And so we really have no pronouncement on the meaning of the Second Amendment from the Supreme Court, other than to kind of indicate that they weren't interested in saying anything about the Second Amendment. For, you know, close to 70 years. Recently, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit struck down the District of Columbia's gun control law, which prohibits the ownership of handguns and requires that rifles and shotguns that you possess at home have to either be kept unloaded or with trigger locks on them. The D.C. court said that both of these provisions violate the Second Amendment, that the Second Amendment does, in fact, confer a right of individuals to own guns and isn't limited to state militia. The District of Columbia, after much kind of agonizing, decided it had no choice but to appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court should decide, as I said, in late October or early November whether to hear the case. I mean, the first issue is you know, does the court have something to say, something on its mind about the meaning of the Second Amendment? There are corollary issues as well. Does the Second Amendment apply to the states or just to federal law or federal enclaves? And then if it applies only to federal, you remember... those of you that have already had con law remember talking about incorporation. Well, the Second Amendment has never been incorporated because it doesn't really mean anything. So one issue would be, does the court want to incorporate the Second Amendment or say that it only applies to federal enclaves? And then if it says that, what does that say about the District of Columbia? Is it possible that it applies to there? Is it possible there's an individual right to bear arms that applies only in federal enclaves like the District of Columbia, but that doesn't apply to the states? Or how does the court want to deal with the status of the District of Columbia? There are some other issues involved too, but it should be very interesting to see whether the court takes the case. So with that, why don't we open it up to questions or additional comments, and thank you all for your patience. Questions? Ethan?
Sorry.
Mr. Meyer, just a question about the Amendment case. Could you talk a little bit more about where the president believes that this authority to command state courts is from? Is it some sort of magical or visible to the Constitution?
How to describe an argument that you think is ludicrous. The gist of the argument, and I actually think there's more to it than my summary may suggest, is that the Constitution orders the president to, quote, take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And it has long been the position of this administration, that that includes the power to interpret federal law and to tell other branches of the government how they should follow federal law. Now, whether the executive branch has that power over the federal courts or not, the position of the Bush administration is that it can tell the state courts what federal law is. That maybe it can't tell the Supreme Court what federal law is, maybe that's the Supreme Court's job, but unless and until the Supreme Court interprets federal law, the president's interpretation of federal law, which in his view includes the judgment of the International Court of Justice in the Avena case, should be binding upon the state courts, and he has authority under the Take Care Clause to do that. I'm less than convinced by that argument. I mean, I think the strong argument is that the decision has force, to use the snotty Latin phrase, ex proprio vigor, of its own force. It doesn't need execution, but that's certainly what the administration's arguing in Medellin. I think it's very tricky. I think that would split the court right down the middle. In 1998, in a case called Braillard versus Green, the court took a much narrower look at the effect of Article 36 of the Vienna Convention. Just last term, in a case called Sanchez-Llamas versus Oregon, the court held that state procedural default rules could override decisions of the ICJ. I think it would be a very close call whether this court would say that the ICJ's decision was binding upon the Texas state courts. There are two facts, though, that might help this case, that might help go in that direction in this case. One, Medellin was himself a party to the judgment of the ICJ, and two, the judgment of the ICJ was issued after all of the state proceedings had terminated, so there's no procedural default argument here.
Dan.
The last time the case was before the Supreme Court, the administration argued in its brief that the federal courts do have the authority to override the president's interpretation of federal law, and that if the Supreme Court were to adopt a contrary conclusion about the force of the ICJ judgment, that the administration would follow it. What the administration's argument basically is there's a hierarchy. The federal courts are above the executive is above the state courts. And so I guess their limiting principle is the federal courts themselves. Exactly right.
Other questions?
What the parties are articulating during jury selection? It's all in the transcript. The voir dire proceedings during trial is a stage of the adjudication process, and it's all in the transcript. So what the lawyers are saying, what the judge is saying in response, all of that is included in the transcript. And if there is an appeal because the defendant's lost, that's going to be reported in the court's opinion.
And in something like a Batson case, that level of detail has to go to the Supreme Court because it really, you know, what the court does with it turns on what really happened. You won't always find that amount of detail involved in a Supreme Court case, but here it's really critical.
And let me use that to put in a plug for people who are actually interested in following the Supreme Court as an institution. There's a blog called SCOTUS blog, Supreme Court of the United States blog, S-C-O-T.
They have links.
Yes. Yeah, it's all in here. SCOTUS blog has actually become an effectively authoritative source, even though no one who writes for SCOTUS blog works for the Supreme Court. That is basically a great way to figure out what's going on in pending cases, providing links to all the relevant briefs, giving you a heads up of what the schedule is, and providing commentary for as developments unfold. So, SCOTUS blog is a great resource.
Take their predictions as predictions, not truth, but there's a lot of useful information in addition to the predictions.
They're better lawyers than they are politicians. I disagree with Tom Goldstein that Barack Obama is going to be Hillary Clinton's first Supreme Court nominee.
Corey. Maybe we all want to respond to that, but I mean, I would just say quickly, I think there will be some very divisive cases this term. To tout another blog that I don't have cited in the materials, there's probably the leading expert in the country, besides our own Professor Raskin, on election law is a professor named Rick Hazen, who runs something called Election Law Blog, and he's observed that these voter ID cases have been, every case that has been decided by a court involving voter ID laws has been decided along largely partisan grounds. Republican judges vote to uphold voter ID laws. Democratic judges see it as disenfranchising largely Democratic voters, and it's bad for the country and bad for the law. That's the perception and that's the way it's proceeding. But I don't know that I would count on the Supreme Court to rise above that, having had, one of the largest numbers of those kinds of divisions in its last term. The Boumediene case, the Medellin case.
I don't think Boumediene's going to be 5-4.
They limit it to the one issue.
Right. But the other thing I was going to say, I think the voting will come out much the same this term as it did last term. I suspect there will be more 5-4 cases where Kennedy is on what some would say the liberal side, what I would say the side of, truth, justice, and the American way. I'm kidding. But I'm not really kidding. My suspicion is that it will be an equally polarized court. It just might be the Kennedy jumps back and forth a little more. The real substantive difference to me about this term versus last term is the major issues before the court last term were all hot button social topics. And topics on which there are heavily religious implications, topics in which they're sort of rife with decades of heated debate. I think the stuff before the court this term isn't any less important, isn't any less divided, but I think it's much less socially polarizing. And so my suspicion is that the public reaction to whatever the court does this term will be far less significant. With respect to what happens in 2009, I think no matter who is president in 2009 of whatever party, we will see the court backtrack on presidential power, because it is an indisputable trend in American history that after a period of enlarging power, Congress and the courts together sort of walk back. And I think regardless of who wins the 2008 presidential election, that's likely to happen on the far side.
I mean, I would just add one additional point, which is I think if they take the D.C. gun case, that has the potential to be deeply divisive. I could see the Louisiana rape death penalty case being deeply divisive. This court hasn't done much yet with either Establishment Clause or Free Exercise Clause. There are several cert petitions pending. Actually, the fact that they didn't grant some of them this morning might mean that they're planning to turn down a couple of them, but there are several cert petitions pending that are kind of important free exercise issues, which I think could divide the court pretty deeply. So it has the potential to add more cases to the docket that will involve more hot-button issues, maybe not at the level of affirmative action and abortion, but kind of one rung below that.
And I would be very surprised. I'm sorry. I would be very surprised if the statistic that Professor Rumel mentioned off the top, that Justice Kennedy was in the majority of all 24 5-4 decisions, if that number is under 95% this term, something strange is going on.
Another way to measure the impact that Chief Justice Roberts is having on the court is that it would be not just normal. I could almost guarantee you that this will happen, that he yesterday, when the court had its first conference of the new term, or sometime over the course of the next couple of weeks, will say to his colleagues, you know, the opposite of Emerald's line, let's not kick it up a notch. Could we kick it down a notch? Could we cool off a little bit this term in his capacity as Chief Justice? I would be certain that he's going to do that. Whether it has any impact or not will be something to watch and see. Well, he can't. No, he can't keep them from doing. He has no clout. He has no power to prevent them from doing anything. They can read from the bench anytime they want.
Although he could avoid writing overbroad majority opinions that, you know, prompt dissent from the bench.
He said that. I don't think he would be that specific. I don't think he would say, let's not read dissents from the bench. I think he would say, well,
let's not be snotty in our dissents.
Well, we all read a lot. You know, he would say we all read a lot of commentary over the summer about how angry and bitter and deeply divisive the end of the court term was. Maybe we could tone it down a little bit and seem like we're getting along better. And they're perfectly free to ignore that and have that have no impact whatsoever, but that would be something to watch.
Are you the pot, Justice Roberts? Is this kettle black?
Other questions? Yeah. Jim, we'll have to make this the last because we promised the intellectual property folks that they could get in here to set up for a program.
Jim, you know how I feel because you deal with me 3 hours a week. I mean, even though I personally object to the results of many of these cases, my sort of emotional reaction is not with the results, but with the what seems to me to be creeping hypocrisy in the conservative judges bemoaning judicial activism and lambasting emotional dissents, when I think it's a lot of the means by which they are reaching the results, if not the results themselves, that are prompting that. But I'm on one side of this, and I realize that, you know, it's one side, and indeed it's the minority side.
Thank you.
And I didn't think the rest of us were beating up on conservatives, but so be it.
I will.